This is An Hour with Murray Pariah, produced by WNYC in New York.
In a way, being a solo pianist is a very difficult profession. It takes a lot of work, but it can't sound like a lot of work. It has to sound improvised. It has to sound like you're telling a story, really. And this is, well, in a way, the ultimate. We very rarely achieve that. But that's what I think all pianists try to do.
Murray Pariah was born in New York in 1947. He studied with two legendary pianists, Vladimir Horowitz and Mieczysław Warszawski. And after a triumph at the Leeds International Piano Competition in 1972, he began an extensive and stellar recording and performing career. He has recently returned to the piano after a hiatus due to injury. More on that and many other things in this hour, a conversation with music, featuring the distinguished pianist Murray Pariah.
What are your memories of your first exposure to music?
Well, I started in a way listening to classical music very young, 3.5 years old, was the age at which my father took me to the opera. He loved the Italian opera, and there was lots of it at the Metropolitan Opera, and he had a subscription every Saturday night at the Met, and my mother didn't like it so very much, so he would take me. And those were my earliest memories, around the age of 3.5.
And did you take to it immediately?
I loved it. I really loved it. And I think the sweep of it, the passion of it, if anything, I remember the tenor arias, and so I would try to sing those arias the next day. And it was eventually through that my father thought that I should have piano lessons.
And did you develop favorites? Did you have favorite Italian operas, arias?
Oh, yes. Well, I loved it. At that time, all the Puccini operas, Tosca, Bohème, Butterfly, yes.
And then they started you with piano lessons quite early.
For 4 years old, I started with a neighborhood piano teacher. And at 6, went to, her name was Jeanette Hain, and she was my principal teacher until I was 17.
And as a listener, what were you listening to once you got over the opera stage, or maybe simultaneously with the opera stage? What was?
Well, I was drawn a lot to Beethoven. I listened. I remember my father had recordings of the Emperor Concerto, the Fifth Symphony, the Ninth Symphony. Then I would get my own tickets to the Philharmonic, and they always misdirected me when I got there. They said, "No, you want the ball game," and I said, "No, I want to hear the Philharmonic." And so I'd buy my own tickets on Sunday afternoon and would go to some of the subscription concerts. I think Bernstein was the conductor in those days.
What were the first pianists you started listening to?
I think the pianist that I listened to the most was Rubinstein. I went to practically every recital that he gave. And then also there were cheaper concerts, because we weren't a very well-off family. There were cheaper concerts at downtown, I think it's called People's Symphony or something, and there Gina Bachauer was one of the most popular pianists, so I heard quite a lot of her recitals.
Very powerful piano.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what was it about Rubinstein that interested you?
I loved his sound. I still do. I think it's an amazing sound. The charisma, in a way the romanticism, the passion, all of these things stayed with me.
Arthur Rubinstein, 1964.
So there you were studying piano, and a teenager. What was that like to be misdirected to the ball game and be a teenager studying piano in a serious way? Were you serious by then?
I don't think I was serious until 15. In that, I loved music. I loved classical music and would listen to it all the time. And when I was at the piano, I would always be improvising. But not serious in that I never really practiced. I never liked the drudgery of doing the scales and studying the piece and making it perfect. I hated all of that. And somehow at the age of 15, when I went to a chamber music camp, it was in Blue Hill, and I started working with Arthur Balsam, that I really sort of buckled down and started some serious work, and then I enjoyed it very much. But that was 2 months of the year. The rest of the year was still sort of fooling around. I like to have what I would call a normal childhood, playing baseball with the other boys and going to different kinds of things, not only classical music. So I don't remember it being in any way special.
Was it Balsam's influence that made you buckle down, or did you?
No, certainly not, because he took pride in not practicing. So it wasn't that. It was just, I don't know, I developed a desire to get the pieces as best as it could be at that time. I don't know why.
So when did you get serious the rest of the year?
Yeah, no, a few years, 2 years later. By that time, I was on my own. I had stopped studying, and I had decided to be on my own in order to make musical decisions that I could feel were totally mine. In other words, why am I playing this piece? Why do I phrase it in a certain way? Not because my teacher wants me to do it or because I should do it that way, but because I feel in a need to do it. And I had to decide those things.
So you were kind of struggling to find your own voice?
Very much. Very much. And that took many years. That took many years, and that made for my decision to go into conducting and composition when I went to Manus College, and to continue playing chamber music so I would have contact with other musicians, and see many different ways of making music to help me decide which, for me, was the right way.
And what about improvising? You mentioned that you were improvising.
Well, in a way, that sort of died. I don't know why. But I stopped improvising when I was sort of 18 and 19. I didn't take my stuff seriously anymore. Tried to compose. That's what I was half majoring in at Manus. I don't think I was very proud of my compositions. I didn't think I affected anything. And so somehow it was my playing that I felt at my most creative. So I was involved in Marlborough and did a lot of chamber music there. And somebody from Marlborough decided to be interested in me as a pianist and helped me decide to go to Leeds to sort of, in a way, measure what I could do as a pianist. And then as a result of Leeds, there were a lot of engagements. And I found myself suddenly a solo pianist where I had been principally a chamber music pianist up to that point.
Pariah playing Schumann in 1973 at age 26, just after winning the Leeds International Piano Competition.
Thank you. so you, at some point, you entered the professional piano world. Were you ambivalent? Were you excited?
I was scared. I was scared. For about 2 years, I didn't know that I could handle it, so I took a lot of time off. I took about 6 months of each year off, just so that I could practice and learn the repertoire. And in a way, all the solo repertoire that I've learned, or at least most of it, was from that time.
Really?
Yeah. I kept, or that is, from that time I started learning the repertoire that later I played.
What was scary about entering that world?
Well, to do that, to be faced with all this solo repertoire, whereas I had chamber music, in a way you could even hide behind your people that you're playing with, to be so exposed, and also on a regular basis. This was, we were talking about 40 concerts at that time a year. Later it went on more. This was quite a daunting experience.
You said a nice thing about Bach, about the combination of inevitability and surprise, which I guess is also what a performer looks for.
Exactly. You want to feel that the piece is, in a sense, being written as you hear it, or is in the sense of being improvised, being completely natural and inevitable at the same time. And that's very hard. That's the challenge.
Mendelssohn, Variations Sérieuses, recorded 1975.
It wasn't so long, I guess, after you became a real professional performing pianist that you did this huge Mozart cycle.
Well, yes, but I did it over many years, so it wasn't all at one time. And it sort of naturally evolved. It was going to be only one record, and then they decided two records. And because they liked it, Sony, at that time it was called CBS, asked me to keep going, and it eventually became a cycle. But it took quite a long while. It involved concerts with the English Chamber Orchestra, which I greatly enjoyed, that is, tours, and at the end of the tour, then we would record the two concertos that we had played on tour.
And you conducted as well on those recordings?
That's right. Because I had been a conducting major at Manus and wanted to make use of some of that. And also, I loved the idea of making chamber music, and a direct kind of contact with the orchestral players seemed to me ideal for these concertos, especially with their very extended woodwind parts that were very soloistic. So it seemed natural that I just accompany them straightforwardly like a pianist would and not have the conductor in the middle of it. And it just seemed to work.
From the Mozart cycle, the 17th concerto, K453, third movement. Was Murray Pariah as soloist and conductor of the English Chamber Orchestra. You're listening to An Hour with Murray Pariah, a conversation with music. I'm Sarah Fischko. Any favorite records you used to listen to when you were younger?
Well, I loved Casals, and perhaps because of Marlborough, perhaps also because of getting to know him, but I think it's deeper. It's something in his music making that spoke very deeply to me, so I listened to his records a lot. And pianistically, I listened to Courtauld. It started, of course, with the trio, with Casals, Thibault, and then his Chopin and Schumann. I felt extraordinary, so I listened to a lot of that. And that, in turn, made me listen to a lot of the other old pianists. And I very much enjoy listening to them, like people like Friedman, Paderewski, Hoffman, Rachmaninoff, of course, was one of the greatest pianists. They gave more than just piano playing. It was a magical experience when one listened to them. And so I do listen to the old pianists a lot for inspiration.
Rachmaninoff at the piano, 1925. And then, of course, you also have the distinction of having studied with two miraculous and totally different creatures of the piano, Horowitz and Horshavsky.
I was very privileged, indeed. With Horshavsky, that came about because at the age of 19, I didn't feel totally secure on my own and wanted some lessons. In a way, I was supposed to study with Horowitz at that time, and I felt too frightened to do that. It had been arranged, and then I decided, no, I couldn't do it. And many years later, when I called Mr. Horowitz again, we got together, and he told me that he asked me why I hadn't played any Liszt or Rachmaninoff or any of the virtuoso repertoire. And I said, well, I hadn't been guided in any of that. My field had been really the classical repertoire. And he said, you know, to be more than a virtuoso, first you have to be a virtuoso. And so I said, well, how would I go about doing that? He said, well, I could help you. And that's how it started. And it was, in a sense, not really lessons, but more playing for him on an informal basis.
What was it like? What was he like? I'm fascinated by him, of course.
I think you can't be a pianist and not be fascinated by Horowitz. It's just too amazing, too titanic.
Vladimir Horowitz, 1986.
It was a force of nature. The colors that he was able to get, the imagination, the spontaneity, the feeling for harmony... It is all on a very, very grand scale.
Was he generous?
To me, very. To me, extraordinarily so. I could see him every day if I had wanted to. And many times I did. I came into New York just to see him and would see him every day.
There was certain repertoire, I guess, that he was much more interested in than
yes.
Others.
Yes. For instance, he told me that he didn't want to hear any Brahms. As simple as that. I wanted to play for him the Brahms Second Piano Concerto, which I was working on, and he didn't want to do that. I think the same thing would have held true for Beethoven. But there wasn't a note of Mozart, a note of Chopin, a note of Schubert that he wouldn't want to hear. So I didn't play a lot of that music to him, except perhaps Chopin, because our talks weren't about that. Our talks were about the virtuoso repertoire. So mainly it was Liszt, Rachmaninoff, the virtuoso works of Schumann and Chopin. But he had a deep love of Mozart.
Is it possible to say how he influenced your playing?
I don't know. I think certain things one can hear, and that is my sense of color was turned on in a large sense by listening to him play and by being aware of what could be done on the piano. The pedaling as well were things that I consciously tried to grasp that he was doing. I don't think I ever got it completely, but I realized that there was a lot of play with the pedals that could be done in playing the piano and bring expressivity to playing. I think those two areas, in a way, technically, and also perhaps in terms of bravura. I remember once I was playing an octave passage in the Spanish Rhapsody, and he was very upset by the way I played it because he said it had no real bravura, and he went to the piano to demonstrate. It was something really inspiring.
Pariah playing Liszt's Spanish Rhapsody. And what about Horshavsky? I mean, I think of him as the other side of the coin, in a way.
Yes, but I think that in personality he was the opposite. Very ascetic. Color wasn't that important to him. Motives always, where the piece came from. That's true. But where I felt that they were similar was that in both music spoke. In both there was not any the remote idea of something mechanical or something sort of that you had to do, but you weren't completely in it. And also they were both very alive to what I feel is the most important thing in music, which is namely the harmonies. They were both very keen to know what notes inspired what harmonies, what colors, how this worked. So, yes, there were many differences, but the similarities were as important as well. And, you know, the idea of spontaneity, which is crucial to both of them, what I say against the mechanical, this spontaneity, I remember Horowitz telling me that one shouldn't sound like one's practicing the piece for the 101st time when one plays it in public after one's practiced it 100 times. That's not the point of the performance. And I think that's very true. It shouldn't sound even practiced.
It's the hardest thing, surely.
It is the hardest thing. And in a way, it also means living dangerously. It means not practicing everything to the ground, but trying to get an idea that encompasses everything that you want to express so that the notes will come, and not practicing them to the ground so that security is the most important thing.
Yes, to be over-prepared.
Yes.
Death.
I think so.
I'm Sarah Fischko, and this is An Hour with Murray Pariah. Coming up in part two, Pariah deals with an injury and has something of a revelation. The program continues after a break. Now, part two of An Hour with Murray Pariah, produced by WNYC in New York. I'm Sarah Fischko. Nearly a decade ago, at the height of a distinguished concert career, Murray Pariah found himself injured and unable to touch the piano for a number of years. His recovery involved both pain and rediscovery of some old musical affections. So I guess we have to talk also about this awful period that you went through with your injury, which I'm sure you've talked about a great deal.
Well, yes, it was a very difficult period, and it lasted, it's hard to say, because it lasted, I think, in total about 3 to 4 years. Towards the end, when the doctors started wringing their hands and saying, I don't think we can help, that was at the point where I got very depressed, because I didn't know that I could ever be a pianist again. And so I started going into a lot of areas in my day-to-day work. I couldn't live without music, so I would listen all the time and try to analyze more and try to study what the essence of music was. For me, it sounds very technical, but voice leading, in other words, counterpoint and harmony, became of complete importance. And I studied analysis and music towards getting to terms with these two different areas.
Let's go back. It started with a paper cut.
Yeah.
And then?
2 weeks later, the finger ballooned up out of all proportion. It was kind of inflammation, and trying to find the cause of it was impossible. And exploratory surgery after a year and a half, when nothing was getting better, didn't help. It made it worse. And I don't know, by the time we found that it was some kind of spur on the bone that was causing these complications, that took about 3-4 years.
It's unimaginable to me to go through that. I mean, you must have been terrified.
Yeah, it was pretty terrible. But at the end of the 3 years, I could risk this operation that might or might not help, because I had nothing to lose at that point.
And the operation did help.
It did indeed. It took a long, long time, I must say.
And then when did Bach come into all of this?
Well, one of the composers that I listened to a lot and that I felt I needed a lot during that period when I couldn't play was Bach. I listened to a lot of the cantatas, a lot of the choral music, the St. John Passion, the St. Matthew Passion. And I became immersed in Bach's music, and then went through the Well-Tempered all away from the piano, because I couldn't touch the piano. But I imagined how it would sound on the piano, and then worked day in and day out with this music.
And where had Bach been before on your radar screen, as it were?
As a composer that I loved, but that I didn't do very much. I mean, I always had a special feeling for Bach. When I was a teenager, my father took me to a performance that Pablo Casals did of the St. Matthew Passion in New York, and in a way, I was so moved by that, I didn't get over it for years. So Bach always held a special place. I remember the Bach concerts that I used to hear every Saturday, or the Bach Society did concerts at Tully Hall or at Town Hall, different places, and I went to hear the cantatas. So it's not a completely new thing, but it was immersed with emotion that meant a lot to me during that time when I couldn't play. There was a time, I remember a discussion I had, in fact, with Clifford Curzon in the 70s, who is a wonderful pianist, and he said, you know, you cannot play Bach on the piano. You just cannot do it. And I remember reading something that Arau had written at that very time, saying the same thing. Even the major pianists were saying that you can't play Bach on the piano. And in a way, that was one of the main inspirations for me wanting to do it. Because I felt this is nonsensical. It can't be that one of the greatest composers of all time cannot be played by pianists. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, also there had been a certain history. I mean, Dino Lipati and all these people.
That's quite right. That's quite right. His Bach recordings are monumental.
And Harold Samuel. I mean, there were many wonderful
That's
Bach
right. And then
players.
It died. There were all of these great pianists. In fact, Edwin Fischer's book of the Well-Tempered Clavier is, for me, one of the great piano records there is. And then it died. It was only Glenn Gould, and it was only playing in this very special way that he had. And somehow to play Bach with the pedal and to play Bach using the sounds that the piano could give you was considered something you didn't do.
I find it interesting, though, that you went to the harpsichord as a way of sort of finding your way into Bach playing.
That's right. I was determined that I would get Bach eventually on the piano, but I was going to go with the fashion, which was original instruments, and I was going to try to get to the bottom of it. And in a way, I was lucky because I was able to enjoy my work on the harpsichord and see that there were a lot of expressive possibilities that, as pianists, we didn't know about. Articulation, holding over, taking time, rubato, note inegal, all of these expressive devices that a harpsichordist has to use because there are no dynamics. And when I came to the piano, I had a bigger landscape in a way. I think that this music is very expressive, and I think that you have to use all the expressive capabilities in order to say what is going on in the music, which is, you know, deeply spiritual and deeply feeling. There's a mistake about calling this kind of playing romantic. The minute that you get kind of playing that has feeling in it, critics immediately say, well, that's romantic. Well, it's not romantic. It's just music with feeling. The romantic composers were expressing very different things from Bach. They were expressing their personal frustrations, fulfillments, their personal histories. Bach's is a dialogue with God, in a way. It's a completely different thing. But to say that there's no emotion in that, that's also something unacceptable.
But you've also attributed to Bach kind of healing powers regarding your own recovery.
Well, yes. For me, I felt it was very necessary to hear this music, and it gave me a lot of solace. That it had an emotional, is to, in a word, a way, soft a word. It has a spiritual dimension that I felt close to.
Did it also give you a kind of pianistic recovery?
I didn't use it in terms of getting back pianistically at that time, but I did start playing it shortly after I was better, and I do feel it helps you a lot pianistically in terms of independence of the fingers, because in a fugue you have to bring all the voices to life, really. It helps you in cantabile to shape a phrase so that each finger has to follow the other finger normally the way a singer would sing a phrase. It helps you in fluency. So in many ways.
This past October, Pariah's recording of the Bach Goldberg Variations was released to ecstatic reviews, and he performed the work in several cities around the world. He said it was of particular value in his recovery.
Let's just talk briefly about the Goldbergs, which, you know, they're this issue that we were talking about before of the combination of inevitability and surprise and the intimacy of something like the Goldbergs must surely be an interesting thing to kind of wrestle with.
It was, and, you know, recently somebody was saying something about the Goldbergs, which I found I didn't realize at the time. You know, that perhaps they were written for this count who couldn't sleep at night and wanted to find some spiritual comfort in this very dark night. Well, in a way, that's what it meant to me, but it wasn't one night. It was about 5 years. there is a deep spirituality in this piece that I think most comes at the end, after the 25th variation, which, as I described in the program notes, has the deathly feel of perhaps a setting of the crucifixion. Afterwards, there is the sense, the last few variations, the sense of resurrection. And so there, for me, is a very definite spiritual feel to this piece. It's not just a virtuoso piano piece.
to say nothing of the return of the theme at the very end.
To say nothing of that, which must be one of the most moving things in all of music, when this simple theme comes back after having revealed itself of such complexity and such possibilities, and it comes back in all its simplicity, radiant at the end. It's amazing.
Thinking about as you know, do you think about sort of future roads you're going to take musically, pianistically?
No, I sort of leave them to the last minute and let them be a product of my passions at the time. Now, for instance, I've been doing Schubert sonatas, the last sonatas, and I'm very much in love with them, so I'm going to study the earlier ones and go through Schubert in a way, and that's a little bit inseparable from Beethoven somehow, so I'm going to keep on going through Beethoven sonatas.
That's also a bit out of fashion, the Schubert sonatas now, a little bit, isn't it?
Perhaps, yeah. I think these things go in and out of fashions, and fashions I don't think are all that important, because they come up, one thing comes up and then another thing comes up, and I don't pay much attention to fashions.
I was just hoping you might bring them back.
Oh, that would be... I'd like to do that.
But, I mean, is there something pianistically that you haven't done that you think you might like to do at this point?
Well, those things. Keep on doing Bach, the Well-Tempered. And I'm always exploring simply the pianistic aspects of things, like Liszt. Playing the piano better is... something I want to do, and Chopin, the Etudes, actually all of Chopin, is intended not only as great musical statements, which they are. They're amazing musical statements. I was studying an Etude this earlier, and I was amazed at, you know, it's very difficult, and it has great technical challenges, and I guess a lot of it is to do that, but underneath it is such beautiful and profound music. So it's a little bit inseparable. But in terms of just piano playing, Chopin is inestimable. And so I will continue to do Chopin, not only the Etudes. I want to record all the Etudes, but all of the pieces, really.
I mean, you've obviously come a long way now through this awful injury and this recovery. And what do you feel you can say now about,
you know, in the end, it was a blessing. It was a blessing in disguise. You don't see these blessings when they happen. It was quite a horrible time for me. But in the end, I gained a lot from it.
You've been listening to An Hour with Murray Pariah, a conversation with music produced by WNYC in New York. Technical direction was by Edward Haber, with post-production engineering by Paul Ruest. Executive producer was Dean Capello. I was producer and host. I'm Sarah Fishko.
The preceding program was made possible by a grant from the Kaplan Foundation.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.